There's been a lot of discussion and interest as to what direction world leadership is taking at the moment. There was considerable relief in some quarters in Holland when the challenge of Geert Wilders was sort of subsumed into the other parties. We wait to see how far Marine Le Pen will get in the French elections. And there is a board of world leaders, and for those of you who are fans of the quiz program Pointless, you're quickly scanning the list, you're seeing who's there, and you're trying to work out which will be the lowest score in the game. But we haven't got time to do that this morning. So instead of that, we're going to think about what are the categories of leadership that people seem to be looking for today. Well, certainly people want strong leaders, don't they? People like Putin, people like Erdogan, who are happy to remove opponents by any means possible, pursuing their wider goals with very little attention given to the loss of civilian life or the means used. Others have styled themselves as anti-establishment, fighting against the given political elites and promising, as we've heard, to drain the swamp. Others would be populist leaders who play on the often unwarranted fears of their people and stoke divisions within their countries for their own ends. Leadership characteristics which we seem to value at the moment: strong, populist, anti-establishment. Well, what sort of leader do you think Jesus was? If you had to pick one word to sum up Jesus' sort of leadership, what would it be? Would it be any of those, for instance? We'll come to that in a minute. Very good. What do you think? Well, what we're going to see this morning is that Jesus was all of those things. He was a strong leader. He was an anti-establishment leader. And he was also a populist. But of course, he was so much more than that. And it may well be that the word you had in your head will reach in a little bit. But obviously, just posing that as an interesting prospect, what sort of leader was Jesus, is neither here nor there, really. The question is, what sort of leader will you be prepared to follow? What sort of leader are you looking for? What sort of leader do you need? That's the question behind. And that's the question we just need to make sure we're confronting and keeping in mind this morning. So first of all then, verses 28 to 40, Jesus was a populist leader who brings joy to his people. We read in verses 28 and following how Jesus sets up this occasion. He makes sure that all the necessary pieces are in place so that those with eyes to see and ears to hear have an opportunity to begin to get closer to who he really is. This is the route Jesus took from Bethany through Bethphage, round the Mount of Olives into the city. And there's sort of an aerial view at the bottom, if you like that sort of thing. But the eagle-eyed and eared among you will already have noticed that although the heading in our Bibles is the triumphal entry, that's not what the text says at all, does it? There's no entry recorded here in Luke. Verse 37 talks about Jesus approaching, talks about him drawing near, as does verse 31, and when he drew near, there's no entry. So we're on the way to, we're on that road that you can see in that bottom picture. So go to verse 36. As Jesus rode along, they spread their cloaks on the road. As he was drawing near, already on the way down the Mount of Olives, you can see where that is, the whole multitude of his disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works they had seen. These are the people who have seen and heard Jesus as he's traveled around the villages. These are the people whom he sort of gathered together like some Pied Piper and brought with him to Jerusalem. This, we might say, is the sort of populist rally that we got used to seeing during the US presidential election and the campaign trail there. Maybe there are even some who've come all the way from Galilee along with his closest followers. But we might want to describe these people as the country bumpkins, the hicks, the rednecks, those who are looked down on by the city sophisticates and the urban elites. That group we meet in verse 39. And some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, yes, a crowd has come out. A crowd has come to see what on earth is going on. What's all the fuss about? And the religious leaders among them are not best pleased, are they? They go on to say, teacher, rebuke your disciples. Jesus answered, I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out. Jesus says, this is such a momentous day, such a momentous occasion that you can't keep them quiet. Even if you make the people quiet, then the stones, is that the stones of the road? Is that the stones of the buildings around? They will cry out. Well, why? Why is this such a momentous occasion? What's actually going on? Well, to get the answer, we need to go back to one of the Old Testament prophets, to the prophet Zechariah. He says in chapter 9, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. That's where we're talking about Jerusalem. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he. Humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. Jesus, this king coming to Jerusalem, is spoken of as righteous. Right with God, living a good life in God's sight. Now think back to our populist politicians. They tend to appeal to the lowest common denominator, don't they? They exploit unwarranted fears, as we thought. They make good use of fake news and spread their lies through all sorts of media outlets. Not this leader. He is of a different order entirely. His character is entirely other. He will never do or say anything wrong. His whole life can be summed up as righteous. God says right with me. God says right in all that he does and says. You'll notice he's also described as humble. Now that's not an adjective you very often hear applied to any politician, is it? Humble. But above all, he is their king. And as their king, he is the one who brings salvation to the people. That was the king's job, to keep the people safe, to rescue the people. Now, we think of how he's arriving. He's on a donkey. He's got a sort of a ragtag collection of people who've come up from the countryside with him. It's not very impressive, is it? We would be expecting a motorcade with outriders and blue flashing lights at the very least, wouldn't we? That's what makes us take note if we're wandering around London and suddenly one of those goes past. We have a look, don't we? This doesn't look very impressive. But again, for those with ears to hear and eyes to see, they might get it. Many, many, many centuries before, King Solomon had come to Jerusalem riding on a donkey in order to be anointed, in order to be appointed as king. That's what you do if you want to say, here is a true king. Here's a king in the line of David. Here is a king coming to his people. And his followers absolutely love it. They're excited by what's going on because this king will be different, and we should be too. Is this the leader that you're looking for? Righteous, humble, king, Saviour? Jesus, a populous leader who brings joy to his people. Secondly, Jesus is a strong leader who weeps over his city. As he drew near, verse 41, and saw the city, he wept over it. Now, most politicians, when they come to the election, they will refuse to give any indication that they think they're going to lose, won't they? They will tell you, despite what the polls are saying, that they will win. They always do that, don't they? Interesting how Jesus does the opposite, isn't it? Jesus weeps over the city because he knows he is not going to win the people to his cause. He knows the very thing they could do to save themselves, they will be unable to do. And the result for them will be catastrophic. Verse 43, the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade round you and surround you and hem you in on every side and tear you down to the ground, you and your children within you, and they will leave not one stone upon another in you. That's what he's saying is going to happen. That's the judgment, the word of judgment he brings on Jerusalem. And when the Romans did destroy Jerusalem in AD 66, the historian Josephus wrote, no one would ever believe that the spot had been inhabited. But they did leave a bit of wall and three towers because they wanted to reveal to posterity how great a city Jerusalem had been. Jesus' words come true. He promised the city would be destroyed, and so it was. So when Jesus is weeping here, these aren't crocodile tears. This is not the crocodile tears of a leader who's just feeling sorry for himself. These are the tears that express his love and concern for his city and his people. And Jesus speaks this word of judgment on them because they failed to recognize what God is doing and they failed to recognize him. Therefore, he weeps because they have brought this judgment on themselves. Look at verse 44, the end of it. Why has all this come? They'll leave one stone upon you, they won't leave one stone and upon another in you, because you did not know the time of a visitation. Verse 42, had you known on this day the things that make for peace? There's no peace for them because they haven't recognized that their king has come. Now, whenever the Bible talks about judgment in these terms, and whenever there is a specific judgment in view, such as AD 66 here, there is also that sense of future judgment, the judgment that is to come. Because there is a day coming when all of us will be called to account. And in a sense, we get a sort of a foretaste of what the question will be. Have you known and served Jesus as King? Have you looked to him for the gift of forgiveness and new life? And Jesus may ask us those questions. He may call us to account because he is the creator of the whole world. Everyone is accountable to him. But we know the question beforehand. We can be prepared. We know we must come to terms with who Jesus is. We know we must come to terms with for whom do we live our lives, for ourselves or for him. We know that he is the only one who can make the way for us into that eternal kingdom. And wouldn't Easter 2017 be a great occasion to acknowledge that king for the first time, to receive that gift of forgiveness and new life for the first time? Don't leave it too late. Today, this coming week, is a great opportunity. Don't leave it too late. Choose to serve him. Know forgiveness. Know the removal of the threat of this coming judgment. Is Jesus the king, the leader that you'll follow? Then verses 45 and 46, Jesus, a strong leader who brings salvation to the world. Verse 45, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold. Now, let's just get this clear. This isn't about selling postcards or having coffee shops in cathedrals. That's not what we're talking about here. That's not the issue, strangely enough. What's going on here is that the temple was being used for things and in ways for which it was never intended. The outer courts of the temple, where all this buying and selling of animals for sacrifice is going on, those outer courts were meant to be the place where the non-Jews were welcome. They were meant to be the place where the Gentiles could come in so that they could begin to draw close and get to know the true and living God. But that place has been given over to something else for commercial reasons. In their temple, there is no room for the outsider. And yet, if you just glance back over the previous two or three pages of Luke's gospel, it's been full of outsiders coming to Jesus. Zacchaeus, the tax collector, the blind beggar, children, a widow, lepers, all outsiders, none of whom would have had a seat at the top religious table of their day. Jesus has come for those outsiders, therefore he will drive the money changers and the sellers out of the outer courts, because he's saying, no, the times have changed, now this place will be used what it should be used for, a place of welcome to outsiders. And the temple, of course, was also the place where God's people were meant to meet with God. But instead, as in the days of the prophet Jeremiah, that is no longer the case. Jeremiah wrote, has this house which is called by my name become a den of robbers to you? What's a den of robbers? Well, it's a place where they hide away. It's a place where they're away from prying eyes. It's a place where they think they've done the sort of the security sweep and there aren't any bugs or wiretaps or anything like that. They can just plot and plan in secret. They can store their ill-gotten gains. They can divide it up between them. A bit like the sort of the famous farmhouse with the great train robbery we'll have seen in the films and so on. We talk these days about people hiding in plain sight, don't we? Jimmy Savile and the like. Hiding in plain sight. What better place to hide from God than in a temple? Brilliant idea. He'll assume we're here for religious type purposes. That's a good thing, isn't it? Therefore, he won't bother to look at us. He won't sort of see through us because he'll be more worried at those outside. Let's hide from God in the temple. But Jesus knows exactly what they're up to. He tells them in a parable in the next chapter that he's seen straight through them. And he will show up their religiosity as a sham because they will say no to him. If they were true, then they would hear him, believe him, and follow him. But it's all nonsense, because they're trying to hide from God, run from God. But you see, this is very good news for us as we sit here this morning. This is great news, because Jesus came to include those who were excluded. The outcasts were those for whom he came. He is for Gentile sinners like you and me. And he is going to wipe away this religious system in order to bring into place something far, far better, whereby through himself all can come to him. Just glance back across to verse 10 of chapter 19 on the left-hand column. Verse 10 of chapter 19, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. You see, the outcasts, the outsiders, the Gentile sinners weren't exactly queuing up, just as in our day. People aren't exactly queuing up to know God. The Jews had their way of running for him and hiding. It was the temple. We have our own ways of making sure that we keep ourselves safe and secure from God, or so we think. No, he came to seek and to save the lost. He came into this world in order to do just that. It's his initiative to do it. He's been described as the transcendental interferer, the one who messes about with our lives, the one who causes us to be sort of destabilized, causes us to feel uncomfortable, causes us not to be able to settle because we have thoughts and things going around about him and about salvation and who's in charge and what's this world all about and why am I here and who on earth am I? And we don't quite know what to do with it all. But that's God destabilizing us. That's God preparing us, working in us, that we will indeed find him because he came to seek and to save the lost. If that's you at the moment, then don't seek to find rest apart from him, partly because you can't, but because it's a sign that he is working in you and for you. Turn to him because he came to seek and to save the lost. He came for us. Is this the leader you will go to? Finally, Jesus, an anti-establishment leader who will die for his enemies. It's worth just having a look at what the establishment think of Jesus, isn't it? Go back to verse 39. As Jesus is being rebuked by them, they call him teacher, you'll notice, whereas his followers are calling him king and lord. So on the one hand, they're trying to make sure that word about him doesn't get out. Go down to verse 47, things got a bit more serious, haven't they? And he was teaching daily in the temple. The chief priests and the scribes and the principal men of the people were seeking to destroy him. At that moment, populism wins out. They can't act because of the people. But they will bide their time. And through the next week, they will have their way. They will take their opportunity and they will destroy him. And of course, for Jesus, it's not just a political career that's going to be dead and buried. He will be dead and buried. And the strange thing about the way in which Jesus talks about his life and ministry, the strange thing about the way in which that is recorded in these Gospels for us, is that we get the very strong sense that that was why he came. Just turn back a page if you want to. I'll read it anyway. Verse 31 of chapter 18. Jesus says, verse 31 of chapter 18, see, we're going up to Jerusalem, and everything is written about the Son of Man. That's his way of talking about himself. Everything is written about me by the prophets will be accomplished. For he will be delivered over to the Gentiles, will be mocked and shamefully treated and spat upon. That's handed over to the Romans. And after flogging him, they will kill him, and on the third day he will rise. That's what Jesus says is going to happen. That's what he's saying is why he's come into the world. And if you go back to chapter 9 where he talks about it, look at who he says is responsible. The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes. This is the establishment at work. They want to silence him, and therefore they seek to kill him. Until, of course, next Sunday, when he proves to be the victor and them the vanquished. What we see, therefore, is Jesus, the King, who lays down his life for his people. Jesus the King who will die as a ransom for many. Jesus the apparently innocent victim of their unwarranted plotting. Now, if we know anything about the way in which national and political leaders operate, we will immediately see that there's a big issue here. All too often, those who come into power seek to line their own pockets and feather their own nests, don't they? All too often, the leader says, die for the nation, die for the cause, die for me. The leader expects his people to lay down their lives for him or for her. Do you see the difference? Jesus, the king, lays down his life for his people. He gives his life for you and for me. That being the case, what will your response be? Will you say, why on earth did you bother? I really can't see that there was any need for you to do that. Or will you in gratitude give your life in return, living wholeheartedly for him, taking up your cross and following him, sharing in his sufferings that you may share in his victory? Is this the leader you want? Is this the leader you will follow? An anti-establishment leader who will die for his enemies. Jesus, the King, comes to his people, comes to his city. And he proves to be a populist, a strong, and an anti-establishment leader. But of course, he was so much more. And above all, he was the King who died for his people. Will he be your king this Easter? Will you serve him with the rest of your days? And at the end of everything, will you know him with confidence as the one who has died in your place and saved you from the wrath to come?